Chairman, your name and addict. And I feel really nervous. In fact, the last couple of days, you know, I've been thinking about tonight and sort of looking forward to it, but also shares going through my head. What am I going to say? How am I going to come across? You know, all the stuff that the self-obsession, the stuff that's been in my head for, I suppose, all my life, really. And when I came into recovery and started to get well, was that I started to realize what these things are all about. Having said that, you know, it's still there at times, and although I tell myself and I know what's going on and do all the things that I've learned, the tools that I've learned over the years in recovery, it's still there, and it can be quite nerve-wracking. But I think what I'll do really is just to tell you my story. A lot of people here, I know a few people here, but there's a lot of people here that I don't know. You know, I've been around for 20 years. I've been in recovery since May 1985 was the day that I actually cleaned up and haven't looked back since. But, you know, and over the years, I know many, many people in fellowship, but it's grown, because when I first got clean, there was a piece of paper like this with the meetings on, and that was it, you know, and there was just a few of us. And we knew everything about everybody, and we used to, everybody knew everybody. And it's unbelievable how it's changed, you know, obviously, and grown in the last 20 odd years that I've been around, and it's fantastic. You know, you just never even would think that this would happen, and there's so many meetings all over the country and so many people in recovery. It's fantastic. You know, I in 1985, when I was actually dragged into a, well, not dragged into a treatment centre. In those days, there was two. I went to Broadway Lodge in Weston-super-Mare, and there was clouds just open. There was just a couple. I didn't know what treatment was. And there was a big shame thing in early recovery that if you went into treatment, you really didn't talk about it. It was only if you came in through the rooms that you were worthy or something. And there's all of these myths that have happened over the years. But, you know, being quelled, like men have, like, talking about AA, if you're an alcoholic, you know, all those things. In those early days, you didn't. They were so purist in the fact that you either came in through the rooms, and if you did go to treatment, you never said it, because they thought that you were privileged. Well, actually, my privilege was that I had to wait 8 months to get a bed to be paid for by these, you know, DHSS, because I'd lost everything. And although it was private, in those days, you know, you never got a bed like these days, which is fantastic that it's available. But, you know, an 8 month waiting list of if you got it, if you were lucky and really, really had to push to get it. Because it was just not heard of. And in fact, the only reason I found out about treatment was I went to a meeting in about 1983, completely stoned up my head because that's all I knew. And my old hairdresser was there, and he said to me, "Manya, you need to go into treatment." I said, "Treatment? Why? You know, I was so stoned, I didn't. Treatment." And he mentioned Broadway Lodge, and I got this thing in my head about Broadway Lodge that I need to go there. Didn't know what it was, didn't understand about recovery, nothing, you know. The reason I got to an NA meeting was the friends of mine literally frog-marched me there. But I had to score, you know, the usual stories. I had to wait to score before I left. I had to use before I went, and I was so sort of like out of it that I didn't really understand anything, and I was very scared, obviously. But I did go to another meeting. I went to a women's meeting the following week, and, you know, what I thought was fantastic, there were these brilliant women there from Sloane Square that had long mink coats on and diamonds, and, you know, because my grandiosity was enormous at that time. And, you know, I thought, well, this is the place for me, you know, that this is these are my type of people. And but I didn't get it for another 2 years, and eventually I pushed for a bed, and I eventually got it. And the reason that I also pushed for a bed was that, you know, I have two children, and I had two children then that were 11 and 13 when I went into recovery. And it was basically an ultimatum that if I didn't do something, that they could have been taken away. Not that my parents would have let that happen, but they allowed that process to happen. because that was the thing that scared me the most. And in fact, it was my pride as well about, of course I didn't want them to go into care and all that sort of stuff, but the fact was that how could I ever live that down? It was the process of my thought patterns then. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. I hate thinking about it. Do you know that? I hate thinking about it now. It's a long, long time ago. I mean, of course I think about it because I, you know, as they say, I suppose it's a drink away, it's a use away, whatever. But I really, really feel that I would not use. You know, I'd never go back to where I left off, ever, ever. And I know that I'm an addict. I know absolutely that I am powerless. I have got step one like you can't imagine. You know, where I went from where I started to where I ended up was just, you know, what a rock bottom I had. I didn't realize it was a rock bottom until, you know, after I came into recovery, because, you know, I came from, I'm a Jewish girl from North London, nice background, you know, had more or less what I wanted. You know, in comparison to what I hear about in the rooms, my family is a bit like the Waltons in a way. I'm one of five children. We are all very close. My mother was an addict. She's dead, unfortunately. She saw me clean, and I come to that. She was a gambler, terrible gambler. You know, we began going to school in the morning. She'd be coming in from being out all night gambling. And, you know, our pattern was at home that she would take overdoses. She was a Tylenol addict, which in those days they used to prescribe Tylenol willy-nilly. It was just that she was so addicted that they couldn't take her off, so she was, you know, an addict anyway. And we'd be, you know, dragging her around the bedroom because she'd taken an overdose because she'd lost so much money and my father's business was in jeopardy. And, you know, but it was normal for us. And, you know, it's only when you look back and you think, my God, you know, it was just normal for those sort of things. And I suppose all the anxiety. And I, out of five children, was the one that I always identified with my mother. And actually, you know, again, looking back when I was a kid, I was a massive overeater. I was treated for obesity when I was about 8 and 9 years old. And, you know, in those days, no one knew about any of that stuff. So there's my pattern emerging and starting, but, you know, who knew that? And, you know, and so having that and having the illness, I really believe that we're born with it. You know, and it could be triggered at any time and for whatever reason, or it's just there. And mine, you know, I hear it so often, you know, I never felt part of, I never felt I belonged, I always felt different, uncomfortable in my own skin, you know, nothing about me. I really, really had very low self-esteem. You know, I was one of four girls in the middle, one that was fat, but isn't she pretty, you know, and all the others were like, oh, you know, all that sort of stuff, and I compared myself. And you know, I didn't start using till I was about 16. I started smoking dope. I'd met my husband when I was 14 and a half, you know, that was my next thing, you know, the love addiction, or the sex thing, or the boys, or, you know, the codependency, really, I suppose, if you want to put a real term to it. And, you know, he was completely the wrong person for me. Well, at 14 and a half, you think you know everything, and, you know, being an addict, but, no, you know, my parents tried to make me a ward of court, and he was an alcoholic. He was 18, and the first date that I ever went on, he was absolutely legless. My parents came back, and he was so pissed that they were horrified because, you know, and they tried to stop me seeing him and ban me and all that sort of stuff, took me off. But, you know, the more they did that, the more I wanted to see him. And we started smoking dope together, and it was really alien to all that was happening in my life, because I did come from that sort of Jewish family that is very cocooned and very, you know, they were very much part of the community, although my mother was this, you know, but it didn't, that was hidden somehow. They were very social and all that sort of stuff. And there was this, you know, he was a criminal as well. And he was the only tick box that ticked that he was Jewish. But anyway, we ended up getting married. And it was, you know, I was 19 years old. And we got married. And my first anniversary was spent at the Old Bailey, where he got 3.5 years for conspiracy. And, you know, again, it was shocking. I went through traumatic stuff and it was shocking. And I didn't know, I could not share this with anybody. My, you know, I was so in such a state. And, you know, my parents actually were great. They were very, very supportive. They said, I will back you to do what you wanted. And it was me, dependent, was going to be there. He went away. I started to have a good time. I wasn't even 21. I was going out. I was getting drunk. I was getting stoned. I was having a fantastic time. And I couldn't tell him because I was petrified, absolutely petrified of him. And anyway, so my, you know, drinking and using taking a bit of, you know, LSD and stuff like that, and he came out. Then he came home about 18 months later, and we're going to start a new life. And, I mean, he was an addict, and everything started to escalate, and it was just a nightmare. It was horrible, and it's not his fault, it's not my fault, it's just how it was. I had 2 children within 16 months, and actually I really thought that that was going to be it. That was going to change my life, and it was going to change our lives, and we were going to have this Cinderella story that was just going to be wonderful, and everything was going to be great. You know, when Aaron, my son, was born, I mean, it was just like fantastic. And then I had a daughter 16 months later. I hit the jackpot. I've got one of each. Fantastic. Meanwhile, there's terrible stuff going on. I didn't use at that time, I somehow or another. But I remember when it really, really started to go escalate was when Bonnie, my daughter, was 11 months old. And I'd been experimenting, you know, after pregnancy, I was drinking, I was smoking dope, I was taking Mandrax in those days, that's what you did. And it was like, you know, it was fun, it was all right. And cocaine was like, it was 1972. And, you know, it was like champagne drug. I was mixed, by this time also had an amazing business, which I was in the fashion industry for all my career, really. And I realized that when I had my son, particularly, there was a niche market for boys' babies' clothes. There was, you know, Oshkosh. I helped Oshkosh bring stuff in. It was like, my parents used to go to America. I used to import this stuff from America. And I started this amazing business as far, you know, children's clothes, designing, manufacturing, importing, you know, vintage denim for kids. And, you know, it was, I was doing really well. So everything was on the surface, all right, you know, I had this amazing business, I had these 2 children, I had this lovely place, I had a husband that was sort of trying, and, you know, and me sort of trying to keep it all together, and I was really quite unhappy, but I just thought it was all going to change, it was all going to be different, and, you know, and then I had some friends of mine moved opposite me. And he was a Persian guy, and he was a dealer in cocaine, and they came over, and he put out this line of cocaine, and I took this line of cocaine, I remember it in my sitting room on my glass table, and I snorted this line, and that was it. That was it. It was like, this is it, you know, man, you're fantastic. I dabbled with loads of stuff. Nothing really did it for me. That did it for me. You know, and it really made me feel how I wanted to feel. 2 children later, 11 months, you know, just I'd lost a lot of, like, self-esteem because, you know, pregnancy, getting back to normal, blah, blah, blah. My husband was, he was so unfaithful all the time, and there was nothing I could do about it, and I was trying to keep it all together. So I was in a terrible state, and Coke comes along, fantastic. It was accepted. It was the champagne drug. It was okay. You know, you didn't really make a big thing of it, but it was fine. To take, in fact, you know, you were part of the elite if you took it. Champagne and coke. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And honestly, my time, that's what it was like at the beginning. Fantastic, I thought. Fantastic. It was good for a few years. It sort of, I suppose it kept me alive, you know. I don't know what would have happened, actually. But from that day onwards, till May the 19th, 1985, was a spiral of complete and utter devastation. You know, going from all those things, you know, material and on the surface and, you know, the kids. I ended up shooting heroin, shooting Tylenol, you know, smoking freebase, we used to call it in those days, similar to crack, anything I could get my hands on. Lost everything, been in twice homeless in one hotel room in Sussex Gardens with the two kids in this scuzzy bedroom and, you know, trying to score. I inherited this enormous house in Tufnell Park, blew that, all went up my arm, up my nose. My businesses all progressed into the most, you know, very successful. Blew everything. Ended up, as I say, in Sussex Gardens. I'm given keys to a council flat. And don't get me wrong, you know, because I felt that I didn't belong in that part. That here I was mixing with, you know, rock stars and this one and that one, you know, and all that sort of thing. That's, you know, and the tears. It was a home. It was a proper home. That I'd taken that all away from my children. You know, they had nowhere. It was gone. And I couldn't see it. The denial by this time was like, you know, it was unbelievable. And the moment I got any clarity, I'd have to take more. Because I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear what was happening to my life. You know, but I actually didn't know anymore. It came to a point in the end where I was so sick that I didn't know anything anymore. I really, really, I was about 6.5 stone. I had sort of rotten teeth, my hair, I couldn't bath. I had the phobia with water, couldn't bath, my hair was all matted. I had track marks, I had, you know, my flat that I got that I had tears about because, oh my God, I'm getting, you know, it was the shame of all that sort of stuff was just a complete and utter mess and wreck. My cousin came over from Canada once and he came up to see me during that period, of, you know, towards sort of the end. And I don't know if any of you have seen a film called Eraserhead. It was a cult film of the, you know, that's what it was like in my flat. You know, it was just awful. It was terrible. You know, the worst part, is that my children were with me. My children saw every single thing that was going on. They were with us all the way through this. You know, I'd left my ex-husband, I had divorced, and I don't know how many times during that period, I'm backwards and forwards, and this one and that one, and affairs, and, you know, with coke, the sex thing that goes with that, you know, and you end up with all sorts of weird and wonderful, not wonderful, but well, you know, whatever you want to put it in its context, weird places. You know, as when you're, you know, when you're clean and sober, you'd never dream of going, you know, just unbelievable. And experimentation and, you know, against all the things that really I ever wanted to do. But I went, you just do it. You know, I was just thinking about the other night, I was lying there thinking, oh my God. You know, it was just unbelievable the place that I went to. And you know, I remember lying in this filthy, dirty bed thinking, you know, I've always felt a winner in life and I felt a complete loser. I didn't care if I lived or died. You know, you hear it so many times, but that was the truth. I didn't know what to do with the children. You know, I did the best that I possibly could. But, you know, it was just devastating. So the family, you know, tried to intervene so many times and just try and push them away. And eventually I was taken to a meeting and I heard this about Broadway Lodge. Jewish social services got involved because of the kids and, you know, I was given an ultimatum. You do something or they're going to be taken away. So I pushed and I got this bed. I got this bed 6 months down the line. How I got there, I don't know. 6 months later, I actually arrived on April the 22nd, 1985 people obviously can identify. Here I am. I'm supposed to be there by, I think, 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I've got to get on a train. No, first of all, I was driving. Then I was going to get the train. then, you know, and meanwhile, I had probably a year's washing to do, so I started to do it the morning of the day that I'm supposed to be going. I'm thinking that I'm going to, because it's private, you see, and, it, you know, I lost all, it's private. So I now have talked myself into that I'm paying for it, and I'm going to some sort of health club type place. Then I'm going to go there, I'm going to get myself well, I'm going to stop using heroin, I'm going to stop using coke, I wasn't quite sure about, but I mean, definitely, because heroin was the, you know, you were just the scum of the earth, you know, you never ever told anybody that you were taking heroin. I mean, by the you had no choice but to know when you looked at me, although I thought, because the day that I got to the train station at the night, in the night, and I remember I had all these bags, and there I was on the train, and someone came up to me and said, "Do you want a score?" And I said, how dare you? You know, I mean, because you could see that it was just so, I was so deluded about myself, that I really thought that I was this other person. And I arrived in Weston-super-Mare, and I had to get to Bristol, and I had to get there and get, because it was so late, I had to get a cab. And I was telling the cab driver that, you know, I'm going to this, and I'm paying for it, and how, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, I rap on the door, and actually they never, ever, ever, they were very, very strict in those days, really, really strict. If you, they say after a certain time, if you don't get there, that's it, you know, you don't do it. God was on my side, higher power was with me, because I rapped on that door at 2 o'clock in the morning, and whoever was on call, with a load of smack in my pocket, and a load of coke in that pocket, thinking, oh, well, you know, when I had methadone, and I had my Valium, and I had my bits and pieces just in case I don't sleep. And, you know, I was I had no idea, not a single clue, because I ever, you know, I never ever saw, really, even at the meetings, didn't really believe that people were clean. You know, it was like, you know, that's what I heard, because I couldn't understand. And they let me in, and I don't know how, I went straight into the loo, I took a great big line of smack, and I gave them my packets. I don't know how, why, you know, I just gave it over. Went to bed, woke up in the morning, hadn't got a clue where I was, and this girl came up to me, and she was going to be my mentor, that was going to take me around, and then it sort of dawned on me where I was. I thought, well, you know, I've got bags of clothes. And it was, you know, very different to what I expected, actually. You know, very, very different from what I expected. It was a real hardline treatment. But, you know, I was there. And it was horrific. My first 3 weeks were horrific. I withdrew and I didn't sleep for 21 nights. I was in the most horrific withdrawal. I was vomiting, you know, projectile vomiting, I was shaking, I was hot, I was cold, I ate, I couldn't do anything, I was crying, I wanted to leave, there was an old night watchman at night time, I couldn't sleep, I'd get up at night, because you have these dormitories and the ones that had been there a bit longer, they were sleeping, I resented them, I was sweating and I was freezing and I was hurting and I was in such a terrible, terrible state. And I used to have to get up at night, and the old night watchman would say, "Don't leave." I said, "I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out. Stay, 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 stay." And so I stayed, and they started to, and every morning we'd have to read out the NA book. Again, it was like, nothing would sink in, nothing, I understood nothing, nothing. We'd have these groups, we'd talk about the steps, I had no idea. And I went to my first meeting in Weston-super-Mare when I was, you know, sort of semi. I was shaking. I remember it was in this little room and I was wearing heels that my feet were like that. They were so high. And I had this little outfit on because it was so important to me. Image was so important, you know. This little outfit on, I thought, well, you know, and I could barely, barely walk. And I got to the door and there was this sofa that had no legs. It was really flat on the ground. And the secretary sort of, you know, came and sat down because he could see I was shaking. I was really shaking. And I looked around this room and I thought, oh, my God, everybody's looking at me. Everybody's looking at me. The paranoia and the self-obsession and, you know, the... Oh. It was just how I got from the doorway to that sofa, and then I had to sit so low. You know, all those things, it still stays in my mind because it was so significant. And it meant, you know, it was just, you know, but I think from that time, that first meeting, everybody was so kind and understanding, and I identified, and, you know, it was just, I started to relax a bit and started to get into the program. And then bloody 3 weeks later, an old girlfriend of mine that I used to use with arrived in treatment. Oh my God, she said to me, I've got some Rohypnol. That's all right, because you're supposed to tell people, you know, you're supposed to tell your counsellors, if people come and they've got drugs and treatment, well, you know, you never gross anybody out. Anyway, I'm fine. So what did I do? The next night I took one Rohypnol, got away with it. The following night I took two Rohypnol, and apparently I was up in the middle of the night, walking down some corridor. They confronted me in the morning. I lied and I said, don't be so stupid. It's just that I'm hallucinating because I'm driving. They slung me out and I was absolutely horrified. My parents were on their way with the kids and I said, please, can I stay and let me greet my parents with the kids and let me tell them, no, you get off here. You've got 20 minutes to get out. I mean, it was so punishing in those days. I was mortified. How could they, you know, it's me. How can you send me away? It's me. Anyway, they did. 20 minutes I had to get off the premises. I went down. What did I do? I go down to Western Supermare. I phoned my dealer who was waiting in the wings. It was a bit of a sugar daddy come. Because my ex-husband, I mean, I don't even know what happened by that time. He was still using, you know, and I had this sort of person that gave me drugs and phoned him. He thought of driving down, but it was quicker to get the train down. He'd catch me quicker to get the train down. Meanwhile, my parents were coming down and there was all this going on and I was just mortified. And anyway, I used for a week. I went and my counsellor at the time said, you know, I'm going to let you, if you keep clean for 10 days, I'm going to let you back in. It's normally a month's therapeutic out. It never happened. What did I do? I came back to Western Supermare, and every single day I get the train back to London to this and use and come back again. Tell nobody. Okay, so that's what I did. I stayed in a B&B, and there was all sorts of things that started to happen, you know, about higher power stuff, and I just was just in such a state. And about 10 days in, I knew that I'd have to get it together if I wanted to go back into treatment. There was a little mini convention down, well, it was like a world convention in those days, in Western Supermare. And I'd gone back to London and I came down back for the convention. My mother arrived out of the blue with my daughter. And when the countdown came, I stood up one day clean. I was so scared because all the counsellors were there in those days. I mean, everybody's mingled with everybody. And I was so scared that they weren't going to allow me to go back into treatment. Anyway, I stood up one day clean. I used that night because he came down to Western. I used that night and went back to my B&B. The next morning, he phoned me and said, I've got something for you. And the something was, you know, as much of a packet. I said, I don't want it. I got step one, because in between that, going backwards and forwards to London, I remember it so well, coming back on the train, I couldn't understand why I couldn't stop, you know, I couldn't understand why it was happening to me, and I realised I'm powerless. I understood what it meant. It was like one of those flashes of light. It was amazing. Anyway, so that was the 19th of May. Okay, God, I could go on forever. 1985, and I've never looked back. You know, you're talking about service, you know, I was really lucky. I was about 6 months clean now. I was going to meetings. I was involved in service. I went to Halfway House, and I was building relationships with my kids. I was getting divorced. My husband, I mean, I got some fantastic stories, funny ones, and, you know, all the stuff. But, you know, anyway, so, and I made this commitment to, I loved being in recovery. very small. We knew everybody. It was very exciting. I was so excited about recovery. I was so excited about meetings. I was so excited about the steps. I got myself a sponsor. Unfortunately, I didn't really, you know, for about 2 years, had this wonderful sponsor, but she was smoking dope. I mean, it was a bit dodgy in those days. You didn't really get a lot of... She was still a fabulous woman, but anyway. And I got involved in service, and we had the World Convention in I think it was about October 1985, the World Convention in London. I mean, the most clean person in AA was about 2 or 3 years clean. And the rest of us really were around 6-7 months. And here I was on a committee putting a World Convention on at Wembley Conference Centre. Massive. But it was unbelievable. It was fantastic. So, you know, I got involved right from the beginning. I was involved with conventions, I was involved with service, meetings, secretaryship. I mean, I did everything, and loved it for years and years and years. You know, it was a big conflict with the kids because they'd lost their mother to addiction. I'd gone into recovery, I'd come back, now I'm going to meetings. And I was very involved, and, you know, I still am involved in the fellowship. It is the most brilliant thing in the world. Look at the growth and how it's been. It's just amazing, and how many people have got well and continue to get well because of service, because of the steps, because of the fellowship, because of the camaraderie, because of the support. You know, I've been through the most devastating things in recovery. You know, I lost my mum. She saw me clean, which is fantastic. My daughter was anorexic. I nearly lost her. You know, it was just devastating. I blamed myself. What chance did she have? You know, it was just impossible. She was hospitalized. You know, I mean, she was a 4.5 stone. She didn't want to get well. You know, and now she's a mum herself. You know, and just all these things. I got divorced. That was very painful. I went through, you know, I picked up my career. That was great. And I was in it for quite a few years and did very well and started it. I went on a quest really to get my life back together, my kids' life back together, and a relationship. It was really tough with the kids. It was really, really tough because they were so damaged. You know, I there's a few people here I know that have had children in recovery, and I envy that really, that, you know, I wasn't that mum that, you know, that I could have been. Because I'm a grandmother now, I've got both my children have children. So I can give it a bit, well, I can, but it, you know, I always, if I could ever change anything in my life, it would be that they wouldn't have been affected and damaged like they have been because of mine and their father's using. You know, I have quite a good relationship with their dad nowadays. I'm friendly. We you know, we can talk to each other. We did a lot of stuff together, and he went in. He's in and out of fellowship. He does his thing and whatever. You know, it's not my. Thank goodness it's not. But it's good that we do have a friendship of sorts. You know, but yeah, you know, it's been a real roller coaster ride for me in over these last 20 odd years. And you know, where I'm at now is that, you know, it's just fantastic. You know, it's always been really fantastic, I suppose, if I look back at where I came from, where I went to, you know, at the end, and the way that I felt, and, you know, what recovery has given me as well is that honesty. The honesty to tell people how I feel, to the honesty with my own self. You know, I'm not perfect. I get things wrong. I, you know, drive myself mad. I get self-obsessed. I'm not, you know, this, you know, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, over the years, it's got a lot better. I do understand it these days. It's different, you know, but it's still, nevertheless, it's horrible when it happens still. It's still devastating, you know, those feelings of not good enough and don't belong and all that. I taught myself through all that stuff, but you know what? It's part of the illness, I think, you know, the illness of addiction. It's a horrific. I hate it, actually. What it does to people and what it does to families, it's devastating. You know, And you know, here we are in recovery, and what a wonderful, amazing thing. I got 5 minutes left. You know, I was 20 in May, and I you know, did a chair, and it was fabulous. And what I did was, my brother made a party for me, and with just the family, my close family, and my father's still alive, my kids, and you know, my brothers, sisters, partners, blah blah blah. And I wrote a little something, and got at this party, I acknowledged every single one of them, eye to eye, and told them, you know, how it had been and how it is now, and how I, you know, and how basically, you know, another immense type of situation, but on a real personal level, it was fabulous for me. It actually was so emotional, you know, but I learned all this stuff through the fellowship. I learned all this stuff through, you know, I've worked the steps. I have a sponsor, you know, I still go to meetings. I don't go to a lot. It's not because I don't want to go to a lot. It's just my work, my relationship, my children, this thing, that thing, you know, it's just time. It's just time management. I'm actually not in London that often, you know. So my life has changed and evolved into the most wonderful place. And definitely wouldn't be alive. I was told when I went into treatment, and I thought, well, they say it to everybody, you know, here I was, olive oil, 6.5 stone, and I had this massive infection, you know, I hit something, what do they call it, I can't even remember the word of, you know, sorry? Yeah, thank you. Enormous abscess that was so infected, my whole body was infected, you know, and I had about 2 weeks, if I was lucky, left. If I was lucky. And, you know, here I am today, 20 years later, 20 years older. You know, grandma, mother, partner, first and foremost, recovering addict, I suppose, is my first and foremost. You know, done a lot in recovery, helped a lot of people. I've been helped, you know, done a lot of service. I mean, just the basic stuff. Just back to the basic, normal stuff on a day-to-day basis. Loved it, was excited about it. It gave me back my life. I started all over again. Really, I started, you know, the 19th of May, 1985. And never, as I say, look back, ever, you know. And got my life back and have a great relationship with the kids. Still feel guilty, still drives me nuts. I still feel guilty, but I mean, it's, you know, in comparison, it's so much better. My father is, you know, he's very proud of me. My family is very proud of me. I'm proud of me. And I'm proud of, you know, what I have become and how honest I can be. And what a difference I make to myself in my life. And sometimes I make to other people in my life, and what other people give me in my life, and it's just fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you.